CRISPR is really a naturally occurring defense mechanism used by bacteria to fend off pathogens. It literally cuts the DNA, invading DNA, renders it useless, and defends itself against disease. So using that same precise gene cutting territory, you don't introduce any new genes. All you're doing is taking the CRISPR apparatus, which is a strip of RNA, which will bind to genetic material inside your host, say it's a plant, and the protein will it'll tell you where the protein, where it can start snipping. And you can take pieces of DNA out. You can alter the function of an existing, perhaps mutated DNA. It's doing all this without any introduction of new DNA, and it's more precise. The ultimate would be to have a controlled experiment to say, okay, here's half the planet where we didn't do anything. Here's the other half where we did. And here is the resulting change in temperature.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. The Nobel Prize Committee has just recognized the scientist who discovered CRISPR, genetic scissors that are a tool for rewriting the code of life and potentially a tool in limiting global warming. New science, technology, and a range of farming systems, from conventional to agroecology, regenerative, and organic, have roles to play. Science writer Andrew Porterfield is investigating and writing about the avenues that are being considered or pursued by farmers to slow global warming. Andrew Porterfield is my guest today on Farm to Table Talk. Andrew, as you look over the range of climate change beliefs and actions, do you see any common ground?
There is a lot of overlap there that neither side, especially the lobbying organizations, the industrial organizations, people involved in the politics of it all and who gets to regulate what, they don't want to go there because that's a political game. Zero sum. Organic wins, GMO wins. Two men enter, one man leave. And it's not really the case. What I'm finding with that story, and I found it with a couple of others in the past, was that there are a lot of organic techniques and this whole new area called agroecology, which actually isn't all that new, and conventional farming. They could all, and I think they do all, learn from each other, but there's the political argument on one level, which makes a great narrative. You know, you've got a great story there. You have Marianne Nestle versus, somebody I knew, one of the sources in the story, Martin Kame of Göttingen, and Kathleen Heffern of Cornell. They're more of the pure, of the scientific, you know, more or less at pro GMO side. And then they have some of the other people who I would put into the supplement salesman territory, you know, some of these other organizations that enhance their income by selling supplements. And there's a conflict there too. And there's a strong source of skepticism, you know, that even the public has. And some of that skepticism, by the way, is also deliberately disseminated, with the sole purpose of what they call in marketing sort of cognitive dissonance, you know, creating seeds of doubt in people. As far as the skepticism that's out there, I mean, the Pew Foundation every year comes out with a survey of about 1,900 Americans or something like that. And it's fairly robust. And it asks the question, who do you trust? And the last several years they've done it, number one on the list, like overwhelming, almost 90% of the most trusted group of people have been scientists. Sometimes it's followed or evenly followed by the military. particularly rank and file type soldiers, that kind of thing. But number one has been scientists and business professionals and people, lawyers, politicians. They're way down on the bottom. So there is an untapped, at least people will anonymously admit in a survey that they'll trust scientists over on anybody else. And to me, that just says, come on, we've got to have more narrative that's based on science. And I would say there's just not enough. Scientists are not particularly
articulate, many that I've worked in are sort of shy.
Yeah.
It's not their nature to be out promoting and speaking in public, right, necessarily. Some are very, very good, but I'd say they're the minority, really. Mm-hmm. One thing, now let's back up and get at climate change, because there was a time when that wasn't talked about at all.
Right.
And in fact, initially, all the talk was global warming. Your headline writer kind of covered both bases here, because you managed to mention global warming and climate change. And I thought that was kind of a nifty way to hedge your bets, because whichever one would get your attention, you had them both.
Yeah. Well, honestly, I think global warming, I remember hearing about global warming as the issue was just coming out. There were some lawyers at all places, the Natural Resources Defense Council, who were talking to me about it. And nobody really had. And then we had a terrifically hot summer in Washington, D.C. and New York. And suddenly, maybe this is an issue now. And people started talking about it in terms of global warming. I think climate change, in some ways, I still prefer the term global warming, because it's at least something concrete that people can attach to. I get that climate change is an overall umbrella term that encompasses severity, changes in severity of climate, changes in, in very cold temperatures as well as very hot ones. So it covers that. But climate change just starts to sound more vague. But it's there. There's not a whole lot. There are lots of terms that scientists and writers will quibble about that we don't like. But if once they start adopting it, I thought, well, I'd rather have people talking about it in general at all than not. So
I think that's a really good point, because I'm kind of there too. Because I think that when you started the language or the issue started shifting to climate change, it brought a few more people into the tent that were getting hung up on, this blizzard's going on right now, and you say we got global warming.
Right.
So it brought some more people into the tent, because those that were otherwise very resistant to thinking anything that serious was going on would have to admit that with all these hurricanes and tornadoes and fires and everything else, that the climate's not what it used to be. So whatever that number of people are, that would say, well, okay, I've kind of doubted global warming, but there's some number of people more that can get into the tent for the conversation when you're talking about climate change, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, the overall pattern is still, when IPCC and the Paris Accord talk about disruptions in climate, they are talking about an increase in overall average temperature on the planet.
Yeah.
And that has consequences. That's why you have snow. We're going to have more snowstorms in Corpus Christi, Texas. we're in New Orleans, and we're going to have hotter summers in Sacramento or San Francisco, California. North Dakota will be planting things that they wouldn't even have thought about 50 years ago.
Right. Well, and so more and more people are accepting that's the case. I have no idea what percentage of the population it is. Sometimes I've felt that it was pretty heavily polarized, but more and more people are accepting that's the case. And then the next thing that they're asked to accept is that what humans do are affecting it.
Yeah.
You can say, well, it's going on. And then you get them to say, okay, I can accept it. I understand it's coming from greenhouse gases. And so we've got carbon and methane and nitrous oxide that are creating this greenhouse around the Earth that's keeping the heat in. And as it melts the glaciers, we're not getting reflections and all sorts of stuff. The oceans are heating up. And so people that follow you that far can say, I think there's something there. You know, they probably don't want to go into any more depth than I just did. But then they can accept that. Then the next spot that you, I suppose, as a writer or me as a podcaster come to is, well, what we do make any difference? I mean, if you're willing to accept that the Earth is getting hotter and there will be serious effects, and again, mainly the equator, mainly production zones, the, you know, beachfront property goes underwater, all that, all those things are not too far-fetched. It's just a question of 2050 or 2100, you know. So you kind of meet the reader, the curious person, at that stage. And the ones that are going to even bother to read an article like you wrote probably already accept that there's something to it and there may be something that we can do. And farming in particular has a role to play. And so it seems to me that you're going to meet that reader that's curious, yeah, and somewhat skeptical.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really writing this to try to get into the science of, well, what happens on the surface of the planet? What does that do for something up in the stratosphere? You know, and make the connection, will reducing carbon emissions from diesel-powered tractors or tractor trailers, what percentage will that have on carbon, a layer of carbon and methane in the upper or mid atmosphere. I mean, I just, that's a whole nother science of atmospheric chemistry that I don't even begin to understand, but I think I'm going to have to rely on some other client scientists to say, okay, that this has been pretty well demonstrated as much as, you know, science can quote prove anything. The reader that I was aiming at was somebody who's like, okay, we accept that part. So if we reduce the amount of carbon compounds being emitted here on the planet, on the surface, that will have an effect on greater climate. So we have to kind of accept that hypothesis and then move on saying, okay, here's agriculture's contribution. Here's transportation's contribution. Here are all these other areas. And then I just carved out the area of agriculture and said, okay, here's what people are doing. Here are different ways that it can reduce it. Whether, you know, the ultimate would be to have a controlled experiment to say, okay, here's half the planet where we didn't do anything. Here's the other half where we did. And here was the resulting change in temperature.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously we can't do that.
Well, so
you can do a little biosphere type thing, maybe.
Well, let's skip ahead now then, because let's work our way backwards from the end of your article, from the headline. I mean, what did you learn in the process of putting this story together? Your assignment was to look at agriculture. What did you discover, and was there anything surprising?
Yeah, two big surprises. One was the role of CRISPR in creating new types of plants using gene editing techniques to precisely create different metabolic processes that either required less, less nitrogen, emitted, you know, less methane to produce, maybe just didn't need a tractor every day to disseminate or to pick. And the other was the sheer scale of projects going on to try to resolve it. I mean, there's a huge amount of work being done in labs and on farms and some ways in industries. To look at this, you know, people are taking it, you know, I didn't run into a whole lot of climate skeptics on the scientific or even industrial front saying, well, I don't think this is real. We don't have to worry about it. Yeah. They're working on things, but yeah, the volume. I mean, I have a part two of that coming up. That's it just barely scratches the surface. Yeah, you could do a whole book on just what's take a cross section of what's happening right now, and you could yield about 500 pages, I think.
We should explain, like when you said the role of CRISPR. Some mm-hmm. people yeah. know that CRISPR. Which, I don't know, whether you would refer to it as gene editing or being able to flip the switch as something different than what most people think of as GMOs, although right. others argue it's the same thing. The people that have issues with GMO, you know, kind of transitioning into looking at issues with CRISPR, but there's definitely, you know, differences in the technology.
Yeah, I mean, the most significant one that really appeals to people, especially on the political and regulatory perspective, is that CRISPR does not require the introduction of a foreign gene or a foreign strip of DNA. You don't have to take something. The early criticisms of, quote, GMOs, which really means transgenics. And by trans, we means it takes something, so a gene from another organism and splices it in to the host organism so you can get your target organism to do what you want it to do. Most of the earlier stages of making transgenic plants, say Roundup Ready corn, involved taking genes from organisms and splicing them in. The federal government got concerned about that mostly because the FDA and the USDA and even the Environmental Protection Agency were worried about the introduction of new pests. Could this create a new organism with an uncontrolled gene, you know, that won't, you know, that will wreak havoc over a field, over the planet, whatever. For CRISPR, you're just taking, CRISPR is really a naturally occurring defense mechanism used by bacteria to fend off pathogens. It literally cuts the DNA, invading DNA, renders it useless, and defends itself against disease. So using that same precise gene cutting territory, you don't introduce any new genes. All you're doing is taking the CRISPR apparatus, which is a strip of RNA, which will bind to genetic material inside your host, say it's a plant, and the protein will tell you where the protein, where it can start snipping. And you can take pieces of DNA out. You can alter the function of an existing, perhaps mutated DNA. And so if there's a faulty gene, say that causes sickle cell or some other problem or reduces resistance to mold or fungus in a plant. And it's doing all this without any introduction of new DNA, and it's more precise, at least the way we're. So you start seeing them described as new breeding techniques or more precise gene editing, where you can get into areas where previous transgenics, it wouldn't let you.
When you, again, get back to these types of production, because you can't use genetic engineering for organic currently, although right. I know many people that can make a very good argument on why you should be able to. But yep, but too. it's not right. allowed currently. Yeah. So when you look at this at these systems where conventional can include, and I should also point out that really there's still only a handful of foods that use genetic engineering. The genetic modification you can naturally takes place in just any kind of breeding program, but. The CRISPR genetic engineering, there's a handful, and we grow 375 crops in California, and there's three or four that are using genetic engineering to speak of. So there's not that much of it. But what about on the organic side, or what you refer to as agroecology? What did you learn about the role those farming systems play in contribution to climate change?
Yeah, I'll have some more details in the second part where we're talking about it. And there really is an overlap a lot, and there are some distinct differences as well. And and some of those have made their way into the regulatory structure. That we have a very strict regulatory system for approving any type of transgenic, quote, GMO type foods, and that is not there for more conventionally grown food using traditional breeding techniques. Organic then has, because of the National Organic Standards Board and the National Organic Program, have a very strict set of what's allowable and what's not allowable for getting certified as organic. Agroecology has gotten to be interesting to me because a lot of it, if you talk about the science of it, it's kind of common sense things that some farmers I think have already been doing about soil health, rotating crops, maintaining soil ecology, looking at nutrient composition of, you know, what you're growing, and trying to make agriculture less invasive than it already is. I mean, there's a point where you just can't, you know, agriculture is a ecologically non-natural technology. You know, farms are not what, you know, earthbound organisms were. If you continued evolution without humans, we probably wouldn't have farms. But that said, you can, you know, agroecology does have a lot of interesting ideas, as does organic. The problems I see come up are the more political conflict ones. You start using these as agents of social change, then it starts getting into another realm where, like, okay, we're not talking about farming anymore. Now we think we're talking about opening access to farmland to other people, or either to the poor or to small scale farmers, you know, but is it really helping them? Hard to tell. But all of these have something to contribute to the overall, especially if to contribute to resolving issues of climate change. You know, anything that improves soil health, reduces the amount of carbon being emitted. I think there's a way to, hate to sound Pollyannish about it, but to work together.
Yeah. No, I think so too. And that's one of the, when I was reading your story, it just kind of reminded me the whole spectrum. There are ways that you can farm that are supportive of the climate in their own way. You can take an approach that you could be organic, you could be conventional. There's ways you can do it better. And yet we're still at the stage where the public is trying to make it simple as possible. They'd like to say, yeah, it's just non-GMO or just organic, or it's just agroecology, or just real organic or something like that. And one of the things that that they'd like to, that's coming up more and more, is saying that, well, just don't eat meat. And yet, you know, and again, based on broad generalizations of what animals that burp are contributing, and it's ruminant animals, mm-hmm, but they don't take into account that a cow is a cow isn't any more true than a car is a car. I mean, if you drive a Prius or you drive a Hummer, you're using more gas and more carbon in the Hummer probably than the Prius. And it's the same thing with cows, and it's the same thing with farming systems. And yes, for some reason, yeah, again, people want to make it simple because they kind of like to have a simple solution that's saying, well, if I just give this up, or if I just stop eating hamburgers, that's going to make a difference. No, but
right.
But it's complicated. You're going to be able to make a living writing for a long time, Andrew, if you're going to explain this
thing. Yeah. Although I saw one paper where somebody had done a study on cows, and they said, well, you just change the feed.
That's right. That's right.
And boom, they're burping out less methane.
that's right. And I think the other thing is that pasture raised makes a big difference. But if you end up with some grain at the end of it to feed them, you end up producing more pounds of meat with a smaller carbon footprint. So that's something that's totally left out of the kind of the propaganda and the people choosing sides right now and saying, well, just give this up and just give that up. It does, though, I think, speak for wanting to understand the production systems and and encourage the farmers to say, well, in my system, whether it's organic or conventional, here's what I'm doing and here's why I think it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. You know, it's and I think more farmers are looking at that. I know a lot more scientists are. There are still people who, I guess you'd be guilty of cherry picking data. And this is where the complexity of science becomes an issue, because you have people who are trained in one area and trained in another, and never the twain shall meet. In fact, the story that I wrote started out with a paper in Nature Communications with a group of Germans. And I showed it to a couple of friends who are also agricultural geneticists and scientists. And they said, well, this sounds, and the premise of that Nature paper was that organic was superior to conventional, including genetic modification, used in farming because of methane production, and but they left out land use, which there are sense. So this is where this can really just helps feed skepticism of people who really want to try to get in and get on PubMed or another scientific database and try to figure this out for themselves. It's like, what? Then it's expert versus expert, and then trying to weed it all out. And so I think that's where you and I come in, where we can help, at least I hope, help to translate that so that you have some data. I don't know if it was deliberately cherry picked or it was just outside of their area of expertise. It wasn't something they thought about. It's like, well, you know, if you have to have more land to grow the same amount of organic food, then it's not contributing. And I think there were even transport issues, diesel emitting trucks are sending this somewhere, and that all adds
up. It underscores the need to have institutions like a free medium, also institutions like good government agencies that are trying to play it straight and holding people accountable, because there's going to be some step over the lines. And I know in genetic engineering or GMOs even, there's choices once they decide, well, the technology can be very helpful, but then things come into place like, well, how much of a herbicide do you put on, and should there be restrictions? I mean, you're in a part in an area that has organic farms and conventional farms, and they're right up next door to each other. Mm-hmm. But it does require, beyond being good neighbors, a certain amount of regulation that if somebody is spraying a crop that they can spray with Roundup, for example, and it drifts onto the neighbor's crop, it could kill everything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you hope that understanding of the science is important. You hope that the companies making the products are putting restrictions on their own labels. You hope people are good neighbors and they're careful about applications. But sometimes you just need regulation too, because not everybody is going to do the right thing.
Right. And fortunately, there are regs on, you know, how much pesticide you can use. I think there are even some guidances on, you know, when you should use it, at what point. It's funny to mention labels. My grandfather was one of the authors of the 1939 Federal Seed Act. He was an official in the USDA. And he was quoted one point as saying, like, well, it was the Federal Seed Act, among other things, was the first law to require accurate labeling on seed and other agricultural products. For everything from the accurate contents of whatever you were buying, which was a revelation in 1939, and how you would use it, the label for using fertilizers, pesticides, even seed distribution. And he just said, well, the label is only good as anybody willing to read it. And if they don't, then, you know, it's got to be something that's clear, and it's just got to be there. You know, you have to have these instructions. And I think overall, at least in the United States, the agencies, I think, have been pretty conscientious. There are differences between FDA and USDA and EPA and the whole holistic structure of who regulates what, I think, needs some tweaking.
Well, and even when you talk about labeling, one issue we've got, especially in agriculture, is that most of the people applying these products in the fields don't read English.
Yeah.
And so we're just starting to get these requirements that to be sure that it's in Spanish too. I mean, that's quite a, you know, somebody can check the box and say, well, I've done the requirement, but you haven't done the requirement if you're really wanting to communicate to the people that are using the products and they speaking another language. Mm-hmm. And so, we're making more progress than some states, I think, on that regard, but, it's still a long ways to go too. And I think if you look at the regulatory agencies, they have to be strong enough, again, to when there are people stepping over the lines that they're jumping in. So it's a complex area. And, you know, mm-hmm. Andrew, just kind of in wrapping up, when I was out for a hike before we started talking, and I'm listening to a podcast that was that included a commercial. And it was somebody promoting a product based on it being climate friendly. And it just reminded me, Andrew, that we're talking about trying to have these more in-depth conversations. And yet there's a whole lot of marketers out there that are going to be kind of trying to, what do they call it? Green something or other, greening mm-hmm. their marketing program. And the reason is that they've gone into focus groups and they've said, yeah, I'll buy more of that, you know. So if you add something to the label and say that it's a climate-friendly approach, the more people that are looking for that, it differentiates a product. So
absolutely. And it might differentiate the price too.
Sure, sure. So you're competing with your article, which is what, 8,000 words or something? Or
No, not that. No, the two of them together is probably going to come to about 2,500, 3,000.
Oh, you know what? We're going to get so many more words in this podcast.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm just going to transcribe it and put it up. I can't compete with you, though, but I'm just going to transcribe it and put up our podcast so they can read it. Anyway, your competition something that is fits in a tweet or a label with a starburst on it on the front of a product, and people will, when they get back to the grocery store again, instead of deliveries, will be pushing down the row and looking at the shelf, and they'll see this kind of flashing and climate friendly. There's nothing guiding that. There's nothing that tells, and people are hungry to understand it. So Andrew, my hope is that we can take an article like yours and we can attach it to a QR code on those products and say, okay, somebody sit down, and you're going to have to spend half an hour listening to Roger and Andrew in a podcast.
Yeah,
or 25 minutes and reading his article, and then you pass the test. Go back and shop.
Right. Well, that came up in California with there was a ballot proposition. Oh, it was almost 10 years ago now. Proposition 37, and it was a labeling campaign, and it was focused at anything that was GMO, and then they had to argue over what percentage of it was and what you meant by GMO should label it. And it lost, but some of the questions that came up was like, well, label what? You know, people want to know if their food came from fair trade. Was it union made or not? Where did it come from? Was it domestically harvested? Was it a woman or minority-owned business that harvested? You know, and they actually, we're talking about a QR code where you have about 10 different, and then GMOs, and then is it climate plus, or I guess you want to say climate minus, but that sounds negative. So markers are going to have an issue with that. But you have all of these different parameters that people want their food to have or to reflect. And I think that's, we're seeing that happen more and more. But you could end up having a label of 10 different qualities of it that will forget about saying what it is, that it's a can of beans.
Yeah. Well, and what happened as a result, that it failed in California, passed in Vermont, and they ended up passing a national labeling law. But the way that works is that you have to go into something called a smart label. And there's lots of information, which includes whether or not it was made with genetic engineering.
Yeah.
But it's a real effort for people that are that curious to get to
and
the
CRISPR.
There ought to be simpler ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And CRISPR and gene editing, it's questionable whether that's even going to be included because it's not a transgenic organism.
Well, and I think that as many good things as people can point to on genetic engineering, there are some examples. There's been some scientists in China that's done some experimental things that everybody said, well, I didn't think they would be doing that. And so there are issues. Well, in wrapping up, I really appreciate this conversation. Andrew, I'm looking forward to more stories from you. If people want to find where your work appears, is there any spot that they can go look for Andrew Porterfield articles? Because I think that they listen to this, they get an idea of how comprehensive you are in trying to put stories like this together. But how can they find something that you've written?
Right. I mean, the genetic, I am building up and trying to keep an archive of my stories on my LinkedIn page. So if you look for me and it's Andrew Porterfield on LinkedIn, I have a set of stories in there and I'm adding to that a lot. I just set up a page on a reporter page called Muckrack, you know, from the old muckracking story. It's muckrack.org. I think it's muckrack.org. And you can find me there and I'll be building up there too. And those are a little more comprehensive because I've got, if you look at the Genetic Literacy Project, you'll find all of my GLP stories there. And then Entomology Today, you'll find me through a search there too. But yeah, the LinkedIn, I think, is so far what I'm doing, and probably Muckrack or where I'm going to try, or where I'm really building up an archive of where you can find me. I don't have I have a website URL, but I don't have, we're going through technical difficulties.
Well, now people are going to be able to find you on Farm to Table Talk.
And
actually, we're experimenting with Clubhouse now too. So maybe you'll join us. Okay. Log into Clubhouse where people can chat and ask you questions directly. So we'll have you in sometime. We're going to be doing those on Wednesdays at noon on Clubhouse, and noon is Pacific time too.
Right.
Well, Andrew Porterfield, it has been a pleasure talking to you. I admire your journey, and in a way, I'm kind of following your lead. I'm trying to pursue these same sort of questions, but I can't do it with a pen. Like, I suppose you don't use a pen anymore either.
Only when taking notes.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on here. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.